Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I have asked Lindsay to read the 12 steps.
Hi, Lindsay, and I'm an alcoholic. Happy to be here tonight with all of you. And so step one, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Thank you so much. And I have asked my friend Brad to read the 12 traditions. I think we got you there, Brad.
Hi, everyone. Hi, everyone. My name is Brad, and I'm an alcoholic. 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, our common welfare. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
Yeah. Okay. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority. A loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is they desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Brad. So I got to first get introduced to our final speaker tonight. I reached out to him randomly and I wanted to ask him a question. He said I can take a call at this time, and I gave him a call, and I was curious because I know he had set a conference up like this in a correctional facility, and some of the people that are in here had gone in behind the walls and had set something like this up for the guys that were locked down in this facility. And I was really curious as to hear about that experience. And he gave his time freely. And then when this whole thing kind of started, he and I started talking. he was one of the first people I asked if he'd be interested in participating, and he actually helped me connect with a lot of the other people that have been speaking this weekend. And so I've already had a wonderful experience and been touched by him. And he also happens to have one of those stories that just kind of keeps going. And I'm really happy he's with us tonight. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to my friend Brian.
Thanks, Devin. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic. I'm assuming you guys can hear me. Okay, good. Man, this has been amazing. So by the grace of a loving God, good sponsorship, and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since March 6th of 93, which means I was getting sober about 4 or 5 months before the first FOTS. So I can't tell you how much it means to me, like Friday night and all the founders of the original. And anyway, I'll get to that in a second. My home group is the Smoking Gun Big Book Step Study. So we're and just so you know, I didn't vote for that name. I voted no on that name, but I was outvoted. I wanted to call us Stove Touchers. I thought that was more appropriate. But we are the Smoking Gun Big Book Step Study. We meet in South Dallas. It's like the Oak Cliff, Bishop Arts area. So anyway, shout out to my home group members who are on. So I just want to say something about Devin. I super appreciate you asking, Devin, and the committee. It was interesting when Devin called me, and not about the prison stuff, but about this. I remember, and if Mary Thayer's on this, she'll remember, when a bunch of us started Northeast Fellowship of the Spirit back in 99. And I was 6 years sober. We met on March 6th of 1999. Actually, the first committee meeting was my 6-year anniversary. And I had so much energy, and I was so into it. And Mary Thayer was the... she was the stability of the committee. She was the wise woman of the committee. We were out of control, and they voted me to be the chairman. And I think it was because of the energy that I had. And it's exactly what I got from Devin when he called me. He set this thing up within 24 hours. And I got to tell you, this is amazing, because we are in some strange times, and there are people all over the world on this. And so I'm super honored and privileged to be asked to share anything, and especially to share my story. But the truth about FOTS is, the meat of all FOTS that I've ever been part of is the panels are the meat. That's always what I've experienced. In fact, at NEFOTS up in Maine, the people who tape it, they've been taping for 35 years, conferences all over the country. Jill told me they sell more panel tapes than speaker tapes, like 3-to-1 at that conference. So this is just kind of fluff right here. I want to thank, I do want to get quiet for a second. I'm going to ask, I don't normally do this, but these are different times. I'm sure my friend Tom, and I'm super getting emotional because I haven't heard from this girl in 3 days. She's a sister in AA. Her name is Lisa Kay. She's from Santa Fe. She went to India to get some medical stuff done, and she's trapped there. And I haven't heard from her. She was sending me messages on WhatsApp, and I don't know what's going on. The last message was the ATMs are out of money, and there's no electricity, and they're running out of food. I called the embassy, but I can't travel because I'm too sick. So I'm just going to ask if we can just do a 5-second prayer. Her name is Lisa. And I would just ask that everybody just get quiet for a second, because what I do believe in from the bottom of my heart is there's immense power in community prayer. And so her name is Lisa, and just ask her, ask God, ask whatever you believe in for her safety. So I'm just gonna bow my head for 5 seconds. Thank you. I'll tell you a little bit about Lisa real quick. Me and Tom Yu from Santa Fe were privileged to do a big book study in the prison in December of 2019. She had got it organized. She was very much like Devin. She was like so much tenacity. She was intent on getting it done. And people kept telling her, put it off for a year. And she made it happen. And the weekend before Christmas, me and Tom and her went in. And it was just Tom and I doing this book study with about 30 inmates at this Santa Fe State Penitentiary. And I got to tell you, if I'm really honest, I think Tom and I both had this conversation. Like, we thought it was the worst timing ever because it was the weekend before Christmas. And somewhere during that process of me whining, I had a reality about how many Christmases I spent in the penitentiary alone, seven of them. And I thought, you know, the truth is, we're going to go and hang out with these guys for 3 days, and they're going to get something. If they don't get anything, we're going to get something. And the truth was, we got a lot. So, and she set that up, and then she went to India. So I want to thank all the speakers that have been on these panels. I want to thank everybody that's participated. Last night with Mickey and Marie and Don and Gary, those are the heroes that I look up to, and I've always looked up to them. I could really, you know, Don used to say, we're just storytellers. I mean, that's really what we are. And I could sit at the feet and listen to stories forever. Yeah, I'm just going to share you some experience. You know, Devin asked me if he could call me Shorty P, and he didn't actually, so I'm kind of glad. But truth is, that is my nickname, and I've had lots of nicknames. And so if you don't know me, they call me Shorty P mainly because I'm 6'5", and they think it's funny. Actually, I'm sitting on a pillow right now, so I'm about 5'1". I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1992, and I came to AA court ordered. So I'm the type of guy who you see in your meetings, who sits on the edges, and I look feral, and I don't look like I'm interested, and I just go get my sheet signed. And I'm that guy. So if you see that guy, please give him some love, because I'm telling you right now, nobody was betting on me to be sober long term. Nobody was like inviting me everywhere. I mean, I just wasn't a pretty sight. And I'm gonna tell you the myth around AA, and I don't think there's a lot in this circle, but you have to want it to stay sober. And the truth is, I didn't want sobriety. I just didn't want to go back to the penitentiary. I just got done doing another year, and I was 29 years old, and they had women in AA. They didn't have any women in prison, and I was like been locked up since I was 22, and I got a choice, AA or back, and I chose AA, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I want to thank Juanita, well, Judy and Juanita, but I want to talk about Juanita because there's what a lot of you don't know about Juanita. About April 28th of 2012, so it's almost 7 years ago, I got a text from my brother that my dad had died. And I know that sounds weird, but that's just how I got it. I got a text, dad has died. And I was heading to Santa Fe that night on a flight for a work conference. And I was going to be there Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then flying out. And then I changed my plan to fly out to Tucson to be part of my family's, my father's funeral. And I want to tell you how much love is in Alcoholics Anonymous and how much I have been blessed by some amazing people. Because when I landed in Santa Fe Sunday night, Tom had already set up that I was going to go to the detox and speak at the detox. So as sad as I was, as heavy as I was, as soon as I was picked up, we went to the detox and we shared. And the next night I was already, these things were already set in motion. You know, I was already set in motion to speak on the 11th step at his home group on Monday night. So I was constantly busy. And on Tuesday night, I was sitting in my hotel room and I was not feeling good. And I was having a conversation with my wife, Chloe. And I told her, I said, you know, God, I just feel really lethargic and down. I think it's the altitude. She says, no, it has nothing to do with the altitude. It's that your dad died 2 days ago. And maybe that's it. And so what I know about me is I have this innate ability to just block things off and think it's not well. Self-deception is really big in my life. And then on Wednesday night, I got a home-cooked meal at Juanita and Tom's house. And so they don't know how much that meant to me, but it made everything, that whole week could have been a whole different animal. So I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober in Tucson, Arizona. I'm from Stockton, California. If anyone's from California and you know Stockton, it's a great place to be from. That's where my drinking started. That's where all the drama started. But and then I'm not going to really talk a lot about my you know, I get caught up in my bank robberies and stuff, and I think that's the drama of it, but that's not the drama. If you really want to know how deep alcoholism is and how powerful it is, and in these times, especially these times, there's a lot of fear around. A lot of people are like, what's going on? What's going to happen? And I want to tell you how powerful fear is in my life. I didn't rob banks. The day I went to rob banks, it wasn't because I'm some gangster and because, you know, it has nothing to do with me being a planned, you know, like Point Break movie, you know, like planned it out. It was just some goof. But the truth was, the night before, I had been not paying drug debts, and I'd taken my rent money from my roommates, and I had pretty much burned my life to the ground. I was 21 years old, and I just turned 21. And I had an awakening that I was in trouble financially. Everybody was gonna know the truth. And I had a thought that said, I should just get honest with everybody and tell them that I'm using too many drugs. And I am alcoholic, and I'll get to that, but this is a byproduct of it. And I said, I've been doing too much cocaine, and I'm out of control. I'm drinking every day, and I'm stealing money from everybody, and I should just get honest. And that was an actual thought, me alone in my room. And the next thought was this over, or next feeling was this overwhelming fear that if I did that, everybody would leave me. Nobody would want to be around me. My fiance would leave me. My friends would be mad. That fear of other people's approval put me in a car an hour later with a gun and a friend of mine to go rob a Kentucky Fried Chicken. Now, we didn't do that. We ended up like eating a 3-piece meal. We got scared. But that's where that started. And then I dropped him off, drove out to the desert in my roommate's car to kill myself. It wasn't, it was the fear of what people think about me, fear of what people, if they'll like me. When it says driven by 100 forms of fear, the driver of the getaway car on that bank robbery was fear. It had nothing to do with me. Now, fear didn't do any time. I did the time. But the reality was that put me in the bank that day. And I'm going to get to that. But I just want to let you know, like, these are interesting times. And I think this time, this weekend, and how Devin set it up and how everybody showed up, all these people who probably have, you know, they speak all over the place. I mean, there's some people here that just do all kinds of stuff in AA, and they all had time for this weekend. This weekend was the weekend of Texas Fellowship of the Spirit. This is the weekend we were supposed to do it down in Giddings, and we had to cancel like everybody else. And so this is what we're doing. So my drinking, I'm not going to get too much into my drinking. I'll just tell you a little bit about how, and I'll maybe drive you through the steps, because that'll basically paint a picture of my alcoholism. I hid my alcoholism behind my drug addiction because I was looking at the drama. I wasn't looking at how alcohol affected me. I wasn't looking at, you know, what happened when I'm sober. I was just looking at the drama. So when I got sent to AA, you know, I was believing what they were saying, just don't drink. You know, I believe that. I believe that, well, if I have an alcohol problem, then not drinking, I should be okay. I didn't know I had alcoholism. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I wasn't, you know, getting a sponsor. And in fact, the meeting I went to, there's the Northwest Alano Club in Tucson. It's not there anymore. It's in a different location, but it was at this old dog kennel. And I'd take the bus there from my homeless shelter. And I would go and I would sit in this non-smoking meeting, and there was about, you know, there could be like three groups of people. One group was like anywhere from 5 to 15 years sober. And they were like, you know, just don't drink no matter what, you know, meeting makers make it. And they were saying stuff, and they were sober 15 years. And another group that were really pretty hardcore around making amends, writing inventory, carrying their big books, doing serious work. And then there was another group that were really into, like, it was, you know, right after the 80s. So it was like in the teddy bears and some real fluff. And I got to tell you, as a guy who robbed 4 banks and done lots of time, you know, I was not interested in the fluff, and I wasn't interested in the guys making amends. That's like, I'm not going to do that. And so the guys who were just not drinking and were doing everything like going to the dog track and pretty much doing what they did before, but not drinking, they attracted me. I was attracted to that. And I say that because, you know, it's really important when people are prepared to come in Alcoholics Anonymous, that a message is, because, you know, I don't know if any of those guys were coming up to me that were doing book work. I think some of them were, but they scared me. But when I got, after I relapsed, I went to one of those guys. That's the guy who took me to the steps. That's the guy who introduced me to the big book. That's the guy that walked me up to God and put my hand in God's hand and said, here's one of your lost children. Please help him. It wasn't those guys that were going to the dog track, and it wasn't those guys that were hugging their teddy bears. And no disrespect to either one. I'm just saying, like, I have to have a message of depth and weight, because I am not a middle-of-the-road drinker. I go to great lengths to get what I want to get, clearly. I grew up with an alcoholic, and I don't know, I can't really see the time here, so I don't have no idea what the time is. I'm a little embarrassed about that. My mom was an alcoholic. Both my mom and dad are dead, and my mom died in 2014 and my dad in 2012. I'm 57 years old. I'm the youngest of four boys, and I'm only going to tell you about my mom's drinking just because it shaped an idea and a belief system that I brought in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is that if you're alcoholic and you don't have any control of your alcohol, you're weak and you have no willpower and you need to get it together. Because my mom was a barroom drunk, and my mom, you know, she basically would go to the bar and she would plan on coming home, and she wouldn't come home. And my dad would fight and they would argue, and he would yell at her and say she's weak and she doesn't love us. And so I took that belief system into the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know there was anything called powerlessness. I thought it was just lack of willpower. I had no idea. And to be honest with you, I've been around alcoholics for 27 years. Well, more than that, but sober ones. Alcoholics are the most willful people I know. We have lots of willpower. It's just applied in the wrong place. And around alcoholism, it doesn't work. And so I had that belief system. I also had a belief system that there is no God. And I got that. And I got that because my brother Chucky died when he was 7 of leukemia. I was 5, he was 7. My other brothers were 9 and 11. And when my brother died of leukemia, this is in 1967, pretty much all ideas or language or conversations about God were not part of our life. And I created an image and a concept of God that was never going to serve me. In fact, when I got into the steps, I'll tell you in a minute, but that hindered me, and I was molested at 10. So I had all these experiences that said there is no God, but it was really based on this belief system that I had and the concept that I created. Nobody created it for me. I created it. So I brought all that in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I met Ken, I was sober in AA for a year, and I'm going to tell you about some of my drinking, only how it relates to the steps, because I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I was dry. I was without alcohol for a year, and then I drank. And I was working at a treatment center as a jockey. They had racehorses, and I'm 5'1", 120 pounds. And, the guy gave me a job, and I was jockeying their horses, but I started drinking 2 weeks after my year anniversary. And I got to tell you right now, this is for the Meeting Makers Make It thing. And I get meetings are very important. If I don't go to any meetings, I think I'll get drunk, but I know they're not going to keep me sober, because I went to 2 meetings that day. And then I ended up at a friend's house drinking that night. And I'd been doing 2 meetings a day for a year. So I did not stop for about 2.5 months, 3 months. And then I got intervened on. And then that's the day that everything changed for me. That's the day when I really, what I believe, surrendered. I had a double surrender. I surrendered to the bottle, and I surrendered my will. And it's not like it just happened at that moment, at that time when I got intervened on. People have been intervening on me my whole life. God has been sending angels my entire life, and I have walked right past so many of them. So many. I could tell you so many stories of how many angels God has sent my way, and I'm just like, not ready, not here, no thank you. But on this day, my friend Max, I heard him, and I was allowed the opportunity to be a patient at that treatment center. That was my first test of willingness to go from a staff member to a patient. And 2 days later, I went to an AA meeting, and it was a 6 o'clock meeting, and Kenny W. was there from Tucson. Some of you guys know him. And I asked him to sponsor me, and he gave me a big book, and he told me some things, and he started to walk me through the 12 steps. And what I understood today is because he said, I don't know if he said this. I know he said it, probably doesn't remember, but he told me basically I wasn't in AA. AA is not the meetings. The 12 steps, the recovery process that's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that's AA. I mean, the fellowship is part of it. I mean, sure, we got unity, recovery, and service, but I was just doing unity. And so I'm a all three triangle kind of guy, and I really bought into Alcoholics Anonymous. I love everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. If you get nothing out of what I say today, is I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the bad coffee. I love the guy making terrible jokes. I love group conscience. I didn't always love group conscience. I used to be a guy when I was an area, I think I was the area corrections chair for Area 28. I'd always want to move the question so we could vote on it real quick. And then a guy told me some wise words. He said, you believe in the second tradition that God speaks through the group conscience? And I said, absolutely. And he said, well, is it possible that God speaks through the conversation before that? And that changed my attitude. And I started enjoying the conversations. And I love watching people at my home group who start to go crazy after about 30 minutes. And they're all people in their first 10 years of sobriety. I totally get it. Like, let's move on. And maybe it's just because I'm older and I don't have as much to do, but I love all that. When I looked at the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous on the wall, it seemed impossible. Especially for an atheist, except for a guy who's been thieving his whole life, been stealing. Kenny asked me, he said, have you ever really given the spiritual side of life a fair hearing? And like, no, what does that even mean? And why would I? I was angrily anti-God. And really what it came down to is I was anti-religion. And so we started to walk through the steps, and I got faced with this idea of powerlessness, and I was open to follow directions. I was beat, and I was saying, I'm willing to do whatever it takes, because he asked, you willing to do anything? I said, anything it takes. So I started to examine my relationship with alcohol, and I started to look at the first step, and I'm glad that the doctor's opinion laid on. I'm mad that the doctor's opinion is not page one like it used to be. It should be page one, but I'm glad that he made me read the doctor's opinion, and I started to understand that the powerlessness in me physically is not my fault. It's not my mom's fault. It's not my dad's fault. It's not my brothers who hurt me. It's not anyone's fault. It's just the way I'm built. It's like a guy who has asthma. I mean, who knows, right? Diabetic, whatever. I just have, my body processes liquor differently. And I got to tell you, it answered a lot of questions. It answered so many questions. It answered the question on when I was on parole, why I would go into the bar and say I was going to have two, and then I would order a third, and then I would drink to a blackout, and then I'd drive home drunk, and I'd wake up and I was on federal parole. I just got done spending 6 years in prison. I don't want to be going back to prison, and I have every intention of just drinking two. I know it because I'm sitting in the parking lot saying, dude, you're just going to have two, and you're going to go home and have dinner with mom and dad, because I was 28 years old and I was living with my parents after my 6 year bid. And that was the plan. And I would end up asking for number three, four, and then I'd be in a blackout. Sometimes I'd drive home drunk. Sometimes a friend would drive me home. Most of the times I did. Sometimes I'd go out and get some outside issues and stay up for 2 days. And I couldn't understand why. And I would wake up sometimes after I was drunk and what happened? And I would think, I got to make better decisions, better choices. I shouldn't drink vodka. I got to just do tequila, right? Whatever it is. And it never worked. And so what I understood, and thank God, Alcoholics Anonymous, I met a guy who qualified me and said, let's see if you were a real alcoholic. And I have that allergy. I have an abnormal reaction. My dad doesn't have that. My dad can drink safely. My dad couldn't be alcoholic. He couldn't have been an alcoholic if he wanted to. And I asked him if he ever got drunk. My dad got drunk twice, and he chose to get drunk, and he didn't like it. When my brother Chucky died and when he was in the Korean War, the only two times my dad ever got drunk. So him telling me you got to get some willpower, he's judging my drinking by his reaction to alcohol. And so I understood. I process liquor differently. And when I started looking at the rest of those chapters, I mean, there's 51 pages dedicated to the first step. I mean, I clearly, the foundation of everything I do in Alcoholics Anonymous is based on my belief system in my innermost self. The way it was described in the first step and how Judy described it, I mean, when I hear Chris and Myers and everybody, I mean, they're so spot on. Everything I've done, every amend I've made, everything I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous actively has been based on this belief system that if I drink again, I will die. I don't have any delusion about that. Now, I did, you know, and when it talks about and more about alcoholism, because I'm talking about mental powerlessness. Okay, I'm physically powerless, but then why do I choose to go in the liquor store? Why do I sit in the parking lot and choose to go into the bar? Clearly, it's my choice to go in there. Well, that's what we think. And I think there's a lot of problems with this part. And I meet a lot of smart guys who think, well, clearly I'm not powerless mentally. I just got to make different choices. But the big book, I've never been in denial. I just want to let you know, like, I've been told I was in denial, but I was never in denial. And it never even talks about denial. What it talks about is me, delusional and illusion, right? Self-deception. I'm insane around that first drink. And when I started to buy into that, it was really setting me up for the second step. Because, you know, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Well, there's an implication in that, that I'm insane. And I bought into that. When I realized, because I argued, you know, like, well, sure, I was making a decision. But when I was told, like, well, is it a sane decision to go into a bar and drink alcohol on federal parole when knowing that you could go back to prison when you're told you're not to drink alcohol? I said, no, that's insane. He said, well, can an insane man really make a choice? And I just bought into that. I thought, damn, that's the truth. I'm insane around alcohol. And the thing is, I'm sane around other things, but I'm insane around alcohol, right? I'm also insane. You know, the truth is, I robbed the bank while I was on bail waiting to go to trial for bank robbery. So it's not really... to say I was sane is kind of a stretch, but there were some sane decisions in my life. And if I'm all honest with you, I really thought I was going to get away with that one. I really had a good plan. And I don't know, I talked about that. But so I bought into the second step. And somebody talked, when Chris S. was talking about this, and I think it's super important, the unmanageability for me is this inability, unmanageability for me to control my emotional natures. Man, I have two allergies in the world. I'm allergic to alcohol, and I'm allergic to sobriety. And you give me sobriety without any spiritual structure behind it, I will drink again. That's just the truth. I cannot stand being, like, I'm not comfortable in my own skin. I'm restless, irritable, discontent. I'm high anxiety. I'm full of fear. Everybody's talking about me. I'm self-centered. They're laughing in the corner. I know they're laughing at me. I never went to a party ever without getting drunk before I went to the party. I mean, and I would call that strategy drinking, you know, it's like pre-party. That's just the way it was. I bought into that and I got faced with We Agnostics. And I'm going to tell you right now, We Agnostics is not just for guys like me. I mean, I sponsored a monk once who was agnostic as I was, you know, I mean, he was extremely agnostic and yet he had deep belief in God. And I started to understand and thank God for the question, which is I got to be just willing to believe, because I was willing to believe. And I started to walk through those steps. And I got to tell you, I did a third step in April of 93, and I wrote this inventory. And I was only taught four column inventory. I wasn't taught anything else. I don't know anything else. There's no workbooks, none of that. It was just straight out of the book. And I started to make amends. I moved out of that treatment center, and I was a year sober. Well, not a year sober. I was about 3 months sober. And I moved into a halfway house with my girlfriend, and we were going to tear it up, you know. And I know you're not supposed to do that, but that's just what we did. And my parents, you know, you want to know the truth around my parents. And it was funny. Jeff G, my friend, he allowed me to be on a phone call. It was a work phone call about some family who wants to do an intervention on their loved one. And I was listening. I wasn't doing anything. I was just listening to the call. It was about an hour conversation. And I was listening to the call, and I was listening to the mom, and I thought, you know, she's all over it. But I just had these, I kept having this wave of how much I put my parents through, how they would come and visit me in prison. And you know, Terre Haute, Indiana is a United States penitentiary. And it's ominous. It's built in the 30s. It's like Shawshank Redemption ominous. I mean, and then my parents, I'm 5'1", 115 pounds going into prison when I'm 21 years old. My parents didn't know if I was going to be alive. And I put my parents through all that. And even going back, and the last time I went back, my parents just, my mom got a hold of Al-Anon, or Al-Anon got a hold of my mom, and they cut me off. And they said, you got to live, you're on your own. I was 29 years old, and you got to live on your own. And thank God they did that. You know, when it says we'll not regret the past, I have to tell you that there's always a piece of me that regrets that. You know, I can't change it. I know that. But I truly wish I did not put my parents through that. On the flip side, my parents, got to see 20 years of a sober man, and they got to see their son get married and have grandkids. They had grandkids, and they never believed that was going to happen. So the healing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is profound and amazing. And but when I was 3 or 4 months sober, they weren't having anything to do with me. They weren't really trusting me, and I didn't have any money. And I worked 2 jobs. I was selling neon sculptures on the street corners, which is a great job when you're newly sober. And then I was working at this halfway house because I didn't have any money. The kindness of this man, because I literally went up to him and said, "Hey, I'm leaving treatment. Can I stay at your place? I don't have any money, but I'll do anything you want." And he said, "Absolutely." He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, "Absolutely." And I said, "Oh, by the way, I got a girlfriend." He said, "Well, bring her." And that's where I lived for the next 9 months. And during that process, because I really wanted to go to Maine, my wife was from Maine, and she wanted to go back to Maine. And Kenny had said, "Why don't you just tear up some of your amends before you move 2,000-3,000 miles away?" And I didn't have hardly any money, and it was a wise move, and I needed to save some money anyway. But I started attacking the amends process, and I can tell you right now that I'm truly grateful that he had me do that, because I think I would have slacked off, because I was getting back to Tucson maybe every other year, you know. And I had some amazing experiences. I had this guy. Here's a great experience. I the guy set me up for this neon guy had set me up to sell neon sculptures in Maine, which I don't even know why I thought that was a good idea. And all these pieces, there's a lot of pieces, and it wasn't going to work. It's not going to work in Maine. It's not going to happen. We were like rural Maine. No, you can't set up a corner in rural Maine. You get no traffic. So I sent it all back except one piece. I had this blue moon. It was like on a stand, and it was really nice. And it was a smiling moon, and it was sitting. And some of my people on this call probably remember this. We were listening to Joe H. and Mark H. tapes at my house, and we were like maybe a year and a half, 2 years sober. And we were like fundamentalists. I just want to let you know, we were real fundamentalists. And we were talking about the power of God and honesty. And I would sit in the room and I'd look at that neon sculpture. And I was like, "Dude, like, that's not even your sculpture. That's like a $165 piece of equipment." And so I had to send it back to him, and I needed to make amends for it. And I was like, I don't even know how I'm going to find him. Like, I mean, I should have found him in some A means, but I didn't know how to get a hold of him. Literally, Chloe and I were driving down the road. Tucson's pretty big. And we were on, like, I don't know, Grant and Stone somewhere. And the truck in front of me was him. He was right there. And I'm like, I could see it through his back window as he turned. I'm like, "Oh my God, that's Jason." And I chased him down. And my experience has been, when I'm willing to make the amends, things will happen. I mean, I got to take action, but they'll happen. I moved to Maine, and I got to tell you, I love Maine. I love everything about Maine. I mean, like when I saw Lindsay reading the steps, you know, Lindsay and Nate, I mean, there's that's where I met Mary Thayer. That's where I met Don P. And Mary Thayer was the one who said, "You should really get Don," because my home group was going to do a big book study. And I wanted to get Joe H. And she said, "You should get Don." And I didn't listen to her. I tried to get Joe, and he was gone. He was actually in Australia. And I ended up calling Don, not because I wanted him, just because I didn't have a choice. I did not know. I wanted a spiritual gunslinger. I didn't know. I didn't want a Yoda, you know. And what I found out was he was exactly who was supposed to come to Maine. And he was going to be the catalyst to what was to become Northeast Fellowship of the Spirit. And I can guarantee you right now, there's people on this call who've known him 20 years longer than me, but I can guarantee you he's sitting up there smiling this weekend. I can tell you that. Because the language of the heart is strong this weekend. And I met him, and Mary Thayer was so considerate. Like, she would go to these committee meetings, and we were like all under 10 years of sobriety, and we only knew how to communicate through sarcasm. And she would just look at us and shake her head. And she was the stability in what was to be a really good committee. And she told me that the way you guys communicate, she said, "You know, sarcasm is tearing of the flesh." And when she said it, I didn't like it. I was like, whatever. And, you know, but the truth was, I remember looking it up and exactly what it is. And that's how I was learning to communicate, because I was just a baby in AA. I didn't know anything about life. I was so feral. And I watched people like her, and they had what I wanted. And even if I resisted it, you know, And so we moved to Maine, we got a group, and we started a home group, and I started getting involved in service. And, you know, when Devin had called me about the prison, there are some people on this call who went into the Maine State Prison. We had a Fellowship of the Spirit in the prison. We had three of them. And it was done kind of like how Devin did this. You know, I got an idea because I was taking men through the steps, and two of the guys who were part of my original group weren't at a meeting on Friday. And I said, where are those guys? You know, I said, where's John and so-and-so? And they said, oh, they're at Kairos. And I said, what's Kairos? They said, it's a spiritual retreat. These guys come in, this 30, 40 of them come in for the weekend. And I instantly knew that there's precedent already set and that would work. And I ended up getting it going. And I called like Jeff, and I called Court, and I called Tom Yu, and I called Ken W. I called all these people and said, fly in. I don't have any money, but fly in and we'll do this. And there was all people in Maine, Denise and Maynard, and there was just a lot of love. And we went in and carried the message. And I'm going to tell you, I resisted going into the penitentiary. I resisted that. I didn't want to go in. I wanted to just stay out of the walls. And I knew why, but I didn't want to tell anybody why. And the reality was, I had really been keeping a secret, and I never shared this on my fifth step, and I didn't share it. I never even shared it till I was 20 years sober. And it was a secret that had less to do with me doing something to someone and someone doing something to me. And I was at a big book retreat in Indianola up in Washington. And I was the facilitator, which was a joke. I mean, I don't know. It would seem like a joke, but I was there to really have the experience that I was going to have. And I had a spiritual experience at the closing ceremony. And it was a Native American ceremony, or it was, you know, there was no natives doing it, but it was called a blanket ceremony. And all I know is that during that process, I had a feeling of God wash over me that was both. I had two feelings of, I wanted to run, and I had a voice saying, I have you, son, you are safe. And the man who smudged me that night or that day, his name is Loud, and he's just an amazing spirit. And I heard him say, you're safe, you're protected, but he said he never said that. And so I sat there as this happened, and then I went out and I called my wife, and I told her, like, I told a story about an event that happened in prison that landed me in solitary for 9 months. And the story that I weaved for my mom and dad, the story I weaved for everybody after that, you know, how you tell a lie and it just becomes truth, was that this guy tried to steal stuff from me and I ended up assaulting him. And the truth wasn't that. The truth was him and three guys came in and raped me and really did bad, I mean, bad damage to me. And the next day I assaulted him with a buddy of mine, and I've never wanted to kill somebody. I've never felt darkness like I felt on that day. And it took me 20 years in AA to get honest about that. And I didn't even write inventory on it. And I had a belief system around that. Like, I should have fought them off. You know, I should have been stronger. And I got sent to a place in Terre Haute, and I spent 9 months in this 6x8 cell. And I would have said that's the loneliest I've ever felt. But the loneliest I've ever felt was being in AA for a year and then drinking and going to meetings. And I know people on this call have experienced that. I know that. That's extremely lonely. And when I was about 7 years sober, I told my daughter, maybe 10, I was telling my daughter, she was 7 years old, and I wanted to tell my daughter that my experience, because I was sponsoring all these guys from prison, and they were like all coming around, and we knew that the truth was going to be told, and I wanted to tell her that I had been in prison, and I knew me and my buddy Chip were going to go skiing the next day. He was taking his son, I was taking Quincy, and we were going to drive up. It was going to be 2 hours with her in my car, and I got her down, and I just told her, I just said, hey, Quincy, I need to tell you about your dad. And I told her, I said, I had done some things when I was a young man, and I'd committed some crimes, and I spent 7 years in prison. and the tears that rolled out of her were profound. I mean, it was like really deep, and I really thought I'd done the wrong thing. I really believed it was the right thing. And then she told me what she was crying about. She wasn't crying because, you know, her dad wasn't a superhero or whatever. She thought she was crying. Because when I asked her, she said, I go, "What's up, baby?" She said, "You just must have been so lonely." And I remember, like, yeah. And I, you know, I'm going to tell you the truth. Since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous and I've had some dark moments, I've never been lonely in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when my daughter wrote her letter to the universities to get accepted, she put that story. She told about her dad, about, you know, his struggles and his successes that God and Alcoholics Anonymous have done, you know, that you people have allowed me to do. That was her story. I remember she shared it with me, and I was like, oh my God, you know, like, she's going to send us to the universities and they're going to read it. Like, yeah, do we really want this girl here? And then she got accepted to the University of Arkansas. So it's all good. And, you know, this journey that we're all on is amazing. And I got to tell you, you know, I am blessed beyond belief. I have had so many experiences that I didn't even plan on, or things that I wanted to resist. My resistance is so strong. You know, they would call me defiant. I was the type of guy who would do the opposite. When Judy was talking about that, I was like, yeah, I was the type of guy that got in trouble as a kid. You know, I would always resist. I would always go rub up against. And some of it was I wanted attention. I was the kind of kid who would break into schools when everyone else was scared to. I'd climb through the window. My brother had me breaking into houses, you know, like at an early age. You know, I ran away from home when I was 12. And, you know, I've been always against the structure and the disciplines of life. And I've been that way with God. You know, I've been that way where I've heard an intuitive thought, or I've felt an intuitive thought, or I've had an intuitive thought, and I'm like, yeah, that's not it. You know, one thing that Don did teach me, it was never my sponsor, but I did call him a lot, and he used to teach me, or he would tell me that I must live my life by an intuitive thought. It's really hard to live by intuitive thought, because it's really hard because a lot of the things I want, I don't need. And when I'm getting some whatever it is, either a voice or an image or somebody come in my life that's mainly God-centered and it's against what I want, I resist. And that's been my struggles throughout sobriety. I had an experience in the prison. What I would do is I would take these men, and I didn't come up with the idea. Some other two wise men in AA told me that I should take guys through the 12 steps in the prison. That means take them through the 12 steps. That means teach them how to write inventory, do a third step prayer with them, have them write inventory, listen to their fifth step, have them make amends, talk to them about service work. And that's attainable. It's not attainable in every institution, but it was attainable during this phase. And I listened to probably 50 to 100 fifth steps. And they had a room, they called it Brian's room. They just stick me in this room and I would just listen to these fifth steps. And I was at the farm one time and we were doing a group third step. And I don't get spiritual experiences. I mean, I don't get visions. I don't get a lot of that, but the one in Indiola was strong and this one was equally strong. And we had a particular group of men who were really hard. They were really big players on the yard. And these guys started bringing lots of people. And there must have been 15 of us doing a third step prayer. And the power, and I know lots of people on this call have done many group third steps. Some don't have any power. Some have immense power. This one had immense power. And I had a vision that during, it was instant. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I shared it with them. And I wasn't going to, but they could feel the attention in the air. They could feel the energy. And it was like this. And this is the vision I got. And it was like that. It was like I was in this forest of alcoholism. I was in this deep forest. And I couldn't get out. I was lost. Even in AA, I was lost. And then I met a guy named Ken. And all he said was, "You want to get out? Just do what I do." And that's all we do. Just follow me. Step over this rock. Go around this tree. Just do exactly what we do. And you can get out of this forest. And then I did that. And all of a sudden, like we stepped out and the air was super fresh and the sky was blue and the grass was green. I mean, it just was fresh. And then Ken looks at me and he says, all right, let's go back in and get two more. And then we go back in and we get two more. And then we take four out. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. From some guys coming up with a conference, let's do a fellowship of the spirit. We'll do it in the mountains and we'll do it in Indianapolis. And then it's in the mountains. And it, from that acorn, what Mickey said was so true. Like we just plant an acorn and then this oak tree comes out. I mean, look at what's happening right now around the world. Australia, Denmark, Iceland, there's Fox everywhere, Ireland. I mean, it's amazing. It's all about the action we take. You know, what am I willing to do? And so I shared that story with the guys. And when they used to have these award ceremony, and they gave me this plaque. They called me the Great White Hunter, which I don't know why they called me the White Hunter. It was silly, but they called me. I still have that plaque somewhere. That's as silly as that sounds and as insane as that sounds, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful. I would have missed it all. You know, and I'm going to tell you something. The guy who got me into AA, the guy who really pushed me into the halls was my parole officer. And this is a guy who wrote my pre-sentence report. This is a guy who violated me. Well, I violated myself. But this is a guy who really was not a cheerleader of mine. And when I went back to prison he stood in front of the judge. I violated. I was out. I did 6 years and I got out. And then I wasn't supposed to drink or use any outside issues. And I did both. And I tested positive. And he called me and said, yeah, I have a warrant for your arrest. And I went on the run for 9 months. And then I got arrested by the marshals. And when I went to court on my violation, he stood up in front of me, in front of the judge saying, Mr. Percox is a risk to society. He's tested positive 3 times for the substance that put him in the robbing banks. And if he's not locked up, he will do that again. And I was mad at him. And when I wrote inventory, he was one of my first ones. Tim, why? Violated me. You know what the fourth column was? He didn't violate me. He just honored the wish. He told me exactly what I needed to do to stay free. And that's been the story of my life. I've been a victim my whole life. And he was the guy, when I got clean on that, he was the guy who sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was the one who sat me down and said, because I drank when I got out after doing that year, and I was at a halfway house. I drank the first day, and he came and saw me, and he said, you know, I could send you back for 4 months, but 7 years, kid, like, what are you going to do? And you need to stop looking at your drug addiction, start looking at your alcoholism, because you have bad. And thank God, he said, I'm going to recommend you go to AA. And thank God he sent me to AA. And I would call him. I stopped calling him after my 6 years because he retired. But I was in Maine. I would call him every year, March 6th, I would call him. You know, and I'm calling the federal parole office in Tucson, and I'm asking for Tim. I'm going to give you his last name because he's in AA. But I call him up, and they would give me, and he'd say, hey, yeah, what can I do? And I said, hey, this is Brian Pergax. And he'd go, yeah, what do you want? And I said, hey, 2 years sober. I just want to thank you for sending me to AA. He said, yeah, God's good, huh? And I did that every year up until he left. I didn't even deserve this, you know. And the heroes that walked before me that paved this way so we could follow the lights and say, okay, that's where we need to go is what needs to happen. And like, you know, the fact I'm 27 years sober is like baffling to me. I'm like, I don't feel 27. I don't feel 57. It's not how I feel. I'm really in a raw spot, but I'm here, you know. And I'll tell you a couple of men's, and then I'll close. I think I don't know. I haven't seen a flash for 15 minutes, so I'm gonna tell you a story. And it's there we go. Nice. So there, appreciate that. Here's the truth. So my brother Chucky had died, and I was 5, and he was 7. And my whole life, I would say it didn't really mean anything. I didn't know him. That's really what I would say. That's the truth. And I never honored him. And then one day I was at an Al-Anon conference and I spoke I talked about my brother dying, and people kept coming up and saying, "Real sorry that your brother died." And I would hear myself repeating time after time, like, yeah, I didn't really know him. And I came out of meditation the next day, and the thought was I need to go make amends to my brother. And at face value, he never ended up on my 8-step, and I never knew why, but I try to pay attention. to the whispers of God. And I asked Chloe, you want to go to Stockton? And, you know, I'd like to go visit my brother's grave and maybe make amends to him. And the amends really was that I never really honored him. And I really wanted to pay my respect. And I had been there 25 years. We flew out to Stockton, and then we walked into this cemetery, and I got some flowers and I wrote this letter, and we walked into the cemetery, and I didn't know where to start. So I went in the office and I said, hey, my brother was buried here in 1967. And, you know, I want to go lay some flowers by it. And they asked his name, and I told him his name. And she said, oh yeah, she took out a map and she said, oh yeah, he's in Lullaby Land. And that just took the breath out of me. And I knew what she meant. I mean, I knew it. I said, what's Lullaby Band? Even though I asked the question, I knew what that meant. She said, that's where we buried all the children. And I don't know why. And I don't know why it took me that long. And I don't know why I was awake to it at that moment. But at that moment, it hit me. My knees almost buckled. And I remember, like, he was a kid. He was 7 years old. And he never had the opportunities I had. And I've just, like, pissed him away. I've taken my life for granted. And as I walked out to his grave that afternoon, I kept looking at the markers and I could do the math, 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old. You know, this idea of gratitude, like I've never been grateful. And I was in AA, but I mean, my whole life, for all the things my parents did for me, all the things that people did for me. I had angels in the penitentiary. I had this guy, Tommy S. He was a mafia guy from Cleveland. He protected me indirectly. He was my mentor. I could write a book about this guy. And I've had all that opportunity. And I made amends to my brother. And I told him I would live my life, that he would look down on me. He would be proud that, hey, that's my little brother. You know, that's my little brother. I'm ashamed to say that that's not how I've acted every time. There have been times where he would not say that. I would like to say that he's probably said that more often than not. And, you know, I was, somebody was TED stepping with me. Well, they were actually technically whining, but it was under the idea of a TED step. And so it was about being locked up and, you know, boredom and just home confinement, and I was listening, and I had this thought, and I said to him, I said, you know, yeah, I get it. I said, but you know, like anytime I've thought, I spent 9 months in a 6x8, like for 23 hours a day, like without Netflix, without a coffee machine, eating 3 meals a day at 6 a.m., noon, and 6 p.m., no commissary, no phone calls. During that 9 month stay, I got a letter from my best friend's brother, which was odd. And until I opened it up, that he had died in a car accident. And I couldn't even call, couldn't go to the funeral. I mean, like, I know loneliness and I know anger and bitterness. And through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've experienced grace and kindness and love. You know, I've experienced the love that flows through the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in the halls. It's why people sometimes don't do the steps, because the fellowship is so powerful, they think that's enough. But there's so much more. I have walked behind some giants, and I'm truly grateful for that. And I'm gonna close. I'm not going to close with my dad's story because I've told it so much this last week, but I'm going to close with a reading. And this is not AA approved literature, but it explains Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's short, and it's from this guy who was Father Henry Nouwen, right? He was a Catholic, Dutch Catholic priest, and it's about compassion. And I think it explains Alcoholics Anonymous. It explains people who I've watched who I'm like, God, that's what I want to be. And so the root of passion means to suffer, okay? The root of compassion means to suffer with. And this is what it says, and this is what he said. This guy was a Yale Divinity, Harvard Divinity, and this is what he says about compassion. And connect how this is Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, compassion asks us to go where it hurts, to enter places of pain, to share in brokenness, fear, confusion, and anguish. Compassion means going directly to those people and places where suffering is most acute and building a home there. Compassion means full immersion in the condition of being human. There is deep conviction that through compassion, our humanity grows into its fullness. This is where we set up camp, in the brokenness of our sisters and brothers. God bless you, and God bless everyone.
By Group Conscience, the Fellowship of the Spirit in New York does not close each meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Instead, we encourage that this whole conference be treated with an attitude of continuous prayer, and we will then say the Lord's Prayer together at the close of the conference tomorrow evening. Please help me close this meeting by joining in a moment of silence. Let us share our spiritual experience and strength with each other so that we can grow together in greater understanding and love.